This morning, our speaker is Roger Cleary. Roger is a professor emeritus at Chicago's Roosevelt University in the College of Arts and Sciences, Department of Computer Science and Information Technology. He is a member of UUFM and an active volunteer. He will be speaking today on the topic of cabbages and kings, DNA, what we all have in common. Let's welcome Roger Cleary.
This is the third of three science talks. Remember, the first one was on the three states of being. The first was physical, chemical kinds of being, and the second was living beings, and the third state of being was the thinking, conscious beings. And the second science talk was on the truth and the methods for finding the truth. This talk is on DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. Whatever that means. This, for the podcasters, this is created under the Creative Commons license. If you have any more topics about science you'd like me to do, let me know. Science is like a giant jigsaw puzzle, one with a lot of little pieces, and the number of pieces is infinite. I'm not good at jigsaw puzzles, but sometimes you can fit several pieces together to form a chunk, but you don't know where that chunk fits into the big picture. Science is kind of like that. One person discovers that galaxies are moving away from one another. Another person proposes the Big Bang Theory. Bell telephone engineers discover the cosmic background radiation, which fit into the Big Bang Theory and the expanding galaxies. Everything fits together, reinforcing the scientific truth. Remember that science is an ongoing process. For today, we explore the UU principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. What does this mean? How interdependent are we? Let's go back to 1831. The ship HMS Beagle launched its voyage around the world with a Unitarian naturalist in tow. Over the course of the trip, the naturalist collected a variety of natural specimens, including birds, plants, and fossils. Through hands-on research and experimentation, he had a unique opportunity to closely observe principles of biology, geology, and zoology. Fast forward, November 24, 1859. On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life, is published in London. In 1861, it is published in the United States. This book established that all species of life have descended over time from common ancestors, and proposed a scientific theory that this branching pattern of evolution resulted from a process that he called natural selection. He, of course, is Charles Darwin. By the 1870s, the scientific community and much of the general public had accepted evolution as a fact, except in Tennessee. This theory of evolution is contrary to the Genesis story in the Bible. So what proofs of evolution are there? Well, first, the fossil record shows that the simplest fossils can be found in the oldest rocks. And it can be shown that there's a gradual transition from one life form to another. Number two, humans, dogs, snakes, fish, monkeys, eels, and many more forms of life are considered chordates because we belong to the phylum Chordata. One of the features of this phylum is that as embryos, all of these life forms have gill slits, tails, and specific anatomical structures that involve the spine. For humans and other non-fish, the gill slits reform into bones of the inner ear and jaw at a later stage in development. But initially, all chordates, embryos, strongly resemble one another. But of course, creationists, intelligent design people, need ever more proof. In 1925, the Tennessee legislature passed the Butler Act, which made it a misdemeanor to teach the evolution of mankind in public schools. People could not be connected to other forms of life. The evolution of the Earth or the solar system could be taught without violating the Butler Act. That doesn't make it right, though. We have all seen the docudrama Inherit the Wind. Who starred in that? Spencer Tracy. He was the lawyer. Yeah. Well, anyway, John Scopes, a winning high school football coach and mathematics teacher who only substituted for the town of Dalton's regular biology teacher, had assigned readings in the state sanctioned biology book. Scopes was never in jail for a moment. He had violated a misdemeanor statute, not a felony. He never faced the prospect of jail and was welcome in Dayton before and during and after the trial, unless, of course, the football team lost. John Scopes unquestionably enjoyed the best legal defense team ever assembled for a misdemeanor trial in the history of the United States, and quite possibly the best ever assembled for any trial. In addition to Clarence Darrow, still regarded by many as the greatest criminal trial attorney in American history, Scopes enjoyed the expertise of Dudley Malone and two other attorneys, a law professor and one from the ACLU, and three backup lawyers, one of which was an associate judge of the Supreme Court. Scopes was still convicted, and he was fined. The conviction was overturned by the Tennessee Supreme Court on a technicality. The fine of $100 was over the limit of what the judge could impose. Anti-evolution movements. By 1927, there were 13 states that considered some form of anti-evolution law. At least 41 bills or resolutions were introduced into state legislatures, with some states facing these issues repeatedly. Yet today, we are still fighting this battle. Okay, most of us UUers think that evolution is a fact. But what does this have to do with DNA? Well, DNA is another big chunk of the scientific puzzle. It fits in perfectly with evolution and fossils. DNA can give us a measurement of the tree of life. It's what we all have in common. The title of today's talk comes from Lewis Carroll's book, Through the Looking Glass, and what Alice found there. In the book, there's a poem about the walrus and the carpenter. The walrus and the carpenter are taking the oysters to join them for lunch, but the oysters don't know that they're on the menu. Time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot, and whether pigs have wings. What connection can there be between cabbages and kings? Well, we now know plenty. The poem is supposed to be nonsensical nonsense. What could cabbages and kings have in common? Well, the answer, DNA. DNA, or deoxyribonucleic acid, is the hereditary material in humans and almost all other organisms. Nearly every cell in a person's body has the same DNA. Most DNA is located in the cell nucleus, or it is called nuclear DNA, but a small amount of DNA can be found in other parts of the cell. DNA is a chemical that stores information, that uses that information to control cell functions, and is capable of copying itself. It's like a compact disc factory that can make CDs, but can also make its own compact disc factories. DNA is digital information like a CD, but much, much smaller and more compact. Being digital helps reduce errors. Being a double helix or spiral, it can unzip and make a copy of itself. The information in DNA is stored as a code made up of four chemical bases. Adenine, call that A, guanine, G, cytosine, C, and thymine T. We're just going to use the letters. Human DNA consists of 3.3 billion bases, and more than 99% of these bases are the same in all people. The order or sequence of these bases determines the information available for building and maintaining an organism, similar to the way in which letters of the alphabet appear in a certain order to form words and sentences. DNA bases pair up with each other, the A's with the T's and the C's with the G's, to form units called base pairs. Each base is also attached to a sugar molecule and a phosphate molecule. Together, a base, a sugar, and a phosphate, they are called a nucleotide. Nucleotides are arranged in two long strands that form a spiral called the double helix. The structure of the double helix is somewhat like a ladder, with the base pairs forming the ladder rungs, and the sugar and phosphate forming the vertical side planes of the ladder. Enough of the chemistry lesson. If you need to know more, ask Jim Howard. An important property of DNA is that it can replicate or make copies of itself. Each strand of DNA in the double helix can serve as a pattern for duplicating the sequence of the bases. This is critical. When cells divide, they need to have an exact copy of the DNA present in the old cell. How much DNA do we share with other life forms? Here are some examples of common DNA as a percentage. We share 87% with the chimp, 81% with a dog, 70% with a rat, 67% with a chicken. Notice it's getting smaller. 17% with mustard weed, and 15% with rice. While cabbages and kings are on distant limbs of a tree, there is some common DNA. DNA shows that we are closer to chimps than cabbages, but we still have some common DNA. At actual size, one human cell's DNA totals 3 meters in length. This DNA must be tightly wrapped to fit into cells, because they're really small. Imagine fitting 900 yards of rope into a backpack, kind of like that. Long ago and far away, when I went to high school, that'd be 1959 at Oak Park River Forest High School, they made a big deal of DNA because the understanding of its double spiral had just been discovered. A short history lesson, how science builds on itself. Johann Friedrich Mescher was the first chemist who first isolated the DNA molecule in 1869. He single-handedly separated out what he called nucleon from cells. We now know this as DNA. The first glimpse of any DNA was like taking apple pie, chocolate cake, ice cream, and cheese, mixing them in a blender, and determining the ingredients are hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, etc. Not too good. Later, Ludwig Karl Martin Leonhard Albrecht Kossel. You gotta love that name. Ludwig determined in 1878 the chemical composition of the nucleic acid. Ludwig isolated and described the organic compounds that are present in nucleic acid. Remember the A, the C, the T, and the G. By 1927, Nikolai Kolos proposed that the inherited traits would be via a giant molecule made up of two mirror strands that would replicate in semi-conservative fashion using each strand as a template. But what that would look like was a detective story. The names of Watson and Crick, with the help of Rosalind Franklin, were the first scientists to figure out the structure of DNA in the 1950s. The story goes like this. James Watson, an American ornithologist, now ornithologist is a guy who studies birds, and Francis Crick, a British physicist, these guys get the credit. Rosalind Franklin did brilliant work developing the technique to photograph a single strand of DNA. She received little recognition for this at the time and died tragically of cancer in 1958. So she could not be recognized with the Nobel Award. In 1951, X-ray The fraction pictures from DNA was shown by a guy by the name of Maurice Watkins at a conference. This was the first indication that the gene might have a regular structure. Watson was there taking notes. In July 1952, Erwin Chargraff visited Watson and Crick and told of his 1947 findings that the ratios of A to T and C to G were statistically equal for a wide variety of DNA. Crick became convinced that base pairing was the key to the structure. Now in 1953, a guy by the name of Linus Pauling, remember he was the American chemist, biochemist, peace activist, and author, considered one of the most influential chemists in history and ranks among one of the most important scientists of the 20th century. Some would say he was the titan of 20th century chemistry. Pauling led the way in working out big molecules, and Watson and Crick saw him as their main competitor. Early in 1953, working without the benefit of X-ray pictures, he published a paper suggesting that DNA was a triple helix. Very interesting, but wrong. In a rush to finish first, Watson and Crick build models out of cardboard and chemistry apparatus. They take a look at Rosalind Franklin's X-ray pictures, an unofficial, unauthorized look. And what they deduced from the X-ray was this, that it's a double helix, it's uniform width at 2 nanometers, and the bases are stacked 0.34 nanometers apart. Watson and Crick build a cardboard model. When Franklin looked at their model, she commented, "You have it wrong. It's inside out." With that clue, they fixed their model and published in April 1953. Fast forward again to the Human Genome Project. The Human Genome Project was started in 1990 with the goal of sequencing and identifying all 3.3 billion chemical units of the human DNA instruction set. Hopefully finding the roots for genetic disease and then figuring out ways to treat it. This is considered a mega project because the human gene has the 3.3 billion base pairs. With that sequence in hand, then they would go on to find problems with DNA. This is not an easy task, especially if you look one pair at a time. Computer help is at hand with something called bioinformatics. Bioinformatics involves the manipulation, searching, and data mining of biological data. And this includes DNA sequencing. The development of techniques used to store and search DNA have led widely to applications in computer science, especially string search theory algorithms, machine learning, and database theory. String searching or matching algorithms which find an occurrence of a sequence of letters inside a larger sequence of letters were developed to search for specific sequences of nucleotides, the ACTGs. When trying to determine 3.3 billion bases, you could do it one letter at a time very slowly, or you could read one word at a time, or better yet, whole paragraphs. For example, W-E blank H-O-L-D blank T-H-E-S-E blank T-R-U-T-H-S, one letter at a time, or one word at a time. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Okay. Or just say the United States Declaration of Independence and plunk 8,045 characters all at once. Okay, DNA is great, but what good is this scientific knowledge to me? Well, let's get personal. My wife and I are both diabetic, and she takes insulin. You could say that insulin is very important to us. Now, a switch from science, the knowing and understanding, to engineering and technology, the doing. In the old days, the days of pork insulin, it took more than 2 tons of pig parts to produce 8 ounces of purified insulin, a wonderful drug, but not human insulin. Synthetic human insulin was first was the first golden molecule of biotech industry and a direct result of recombinant DNA technology. Currently, millions of diabetics worldwide use synthetic insulin to regulate their blood sugar levels. Synthetic insulin is made in both bacteria and yeast. Insulin, which is both a hormone and a protein, is a balled-up string of chemicals called amino acids. There are 20 common amino acids, such as tryptophan, that combine end-to-end to make proteins. Like the letters of a word, the order and number of amino acids in the protein are what define it. Human insulin is a sequence of 51 amino acids, differing from pork insulin by a single amino acid and by three amino acids from beef insulin. The problem, though, is that the body's immune system is a fastidious fact checker, and it knows that animal insulin is foreign. Some people with diabetes develop immune reactions to both pork and beef insulin. Over time, the insulin becomes less effective. And the manufacturers needed a process that was more sustainable and less stinky. In 1978, researchers at the biotech company called Genentech announced that they had introduced a human gene for insulin into a safe strain of E. coli bacteria, which then produced the insulin protein. Genentech partnered with Eli Lilly, which brought engineered human insulin to the market in 1982, the first recombinant DNA drug product in the world. But that was just the beginning for insulin medications. Having the ability to tweak insulin genes, the scientists started to develop new-to-nature forms of insulin called insulin analogs. Analogs have become increasingly popular among doctors and patients. Engineers build desirable properties into analogs by tweaking their amino acids sequences in ways that force the body to process them faster or slower than just plain insulin. The new attributes give people with diabetes more options for controlling blood glucose. This is big business. At Eli Lilly, insulin making E. coli is grown in 50,000 liter tanks called fermenters. 50,000 liters, that's about 13,000 US gallons. And there are more than 5,000 tanks on site in Indianapolis. According to Lilly, a batch of insulin from one fermenter could produce a year's supply of insulin for thousands of people. Our facilities are designed to produce insulin crystals in multiple metric ton quantities. Now, scientists have yet to produce from scratch a living cell from DNA. What we do now is use bacteria, E. coli, for example, like a computer operating system, inserting DNA to do useful jobs, like application programs. But building an application program is difficult, but building an operating system will take some real effort. Science is amazing, science is interesting, and science can be a useful methodology to help people. Denying science is turning back to the dark ages. Next time you eat coleslaw, think of the interconnectedness between cabbages and kings. I'd like to close with a quote from a biological engineer, Ron Weiss, from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. There's a big gap between science fiction, or what your imagination can do, and the reality in the research labs. That's it. Thank you.